welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 12 for August 2008. My name's Paul Davison and I run the website www.stormcock.net. In this episode, we have part one of a three-part interview with Roy Harper. We have the A to Z of Harper, this time the letter L. We have listener feedback and the usual wide selection of music. Now, the podcast is almost a year old. This is episode 12, and I have been working on getting Roy on the podcast ever since we started, as you can probably imagine. So this is a real high point for me, and it is a fitting way of celebrating what's nearly 1 year of doing the podcast, which is amazing, frankly. I started it as an experiment. I did a quick trial run and stuck it out there and thought I'd be really happy if I got 25 or 30 people listening, and the numbers have been much higher than that. I think once an episode's been out for a few weeks, we tend to average 400 or 500 listeners. It's a little bit hard to count them actually for various reasons, but I think I can say with fair confidence that it's been a success so far, and I'm hoping that Roy's interview will really launch us forward a little bit more. Now, if you listened to the Matt Churchill special that I brought out in mid-July, you'll have realised I was in Ireland for a few days because I interviewed Matt at his house in or near Clonakilty. And I was very fortunate, my wife and I were fortunate enough to be invited over to spend a little bit of time with Roy and Tracy, who made us extremely welcome. We're fantastic hosts. I really had a lot of fun. But of course, there was some business involved, which was to do an interview with Roy. Now, Roy is not a reticent person when it comes to talking, so we sat out at a table in his garden and we talked one afternoon, one of the rare afternoons that the sun was actually out and shining, and we ended up with 2 hours and 40 minutes of interview. That's after I've edited things down a little bit as well. So what I've decided to do is split it into three parts, but rather than make everybody have the pain of a month's gap between each of the parts, I'm going to speed up the production cycle for the next three episodes, so it will be out every 2 weeks. So this episode goes out August the 1st, the second part will be mid-August, the third part will be September the 1st, and then we'll be finished with that. Once all three parts of the interview have come out, what I'll then do is put an audio download on stormcock.net just of the interview as one big MP3 file, so that those of you that would like to keep it for posterity have it without me waffling on all the music and everything else that revolves around it with the podcast. The track that's been playing in the background is Blackpool off of Roy's first album, Sophisticated Beggar. Once that track's finished, we'll launch straight into the interview.
Thank you.
Well, this is going to be going out on the 12th Roy Harper podcast, and that means we've been going for almost a year. I can hardly believe that. And it's my extreme pleasure, finally, to get Roy Harper on the podcast for an interview. Hi, Roy.
Well, thanks, Paul. Great.
Welcome to the Roy Harper podcast.
Thank you very much. I hope that, you know, it's not all going to be crap.
I'm sure it won't be crap. Now, obviously, you know, there's a lot we could talk about, and we could be here, as we've already discussed, for a couple of weeks solid, yeah, filling up several hard drives. So I'm going to try and sort of be a bit more concise. When I first started thinking about interviewing you, I thought, yeah, we can have an album by album and track by track breakdown. Then I woke up from my nightmare and thought, no, maybe that's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, that would be a nightmare.
And so I wanted to say at the beginning of the interview, really, that if people want a song by song breakdown, there is an obvious way of doing that, which is to get your book, which contains lyrics and thoughts.
The book's good. It's not, you know, I change. I wouldn't have written anything like that now.
Right.
It would be different.
It's a snapshot, isn't it?
It's a snapshot not only of, you know, 1968 or 1973 or 1987. It's a snapshot also of 2003.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning here. We get people listening to the podcast that are ultra familiar with your work. One might even say obsessive, but there will also be people listening that, you know, have just discovered you, starting from the beginning. So where did it all start? I mean, was music the thing you wanted to do from the beginning? Or I kind of remember reading somewhere that you wanted to have some kind of way of delivering your thoughts and poems and writings and so on, and music may have just been a delivery vehicle.
Well, absolutely. I was inspired by poetry. I wasn't inspired by music at all. Although, the house wasn't devoid of music. It was just, you know, my dad used to listen to a lot of stuff on the radio. It was, and, you know, he had a pretty eclectic taste, really. He'd listen to almost anything, really. And there was a pair of shoes. There were a pair of shoes in the bottom drawer of the first house that I really remember as, you know, living in.
Yeah.
Which were patent leather. And, you know, those were his dancing shoes. I never saw him. I never saw him dance. Never, ever saw him dance. But those were his dancing shoes. They stayed there for years. In the bottom left-hand corner of that drawer.
I wonder what story they could have told.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If only they could have spoken.
Yeah.
You'd have seen a different man altogether.
So, I seem to remember you started a kind of skiffle group, didn't you? Or that you were doing...
Well, yes, First off, really, I was really inspired at school, in the last year of my junior school, by a woman called Miss Yates, who was our, you know, teacher of everything, I think, at the time. That's, you know, how schools were then. You know, there was the first, your five-year-old form, your six, sevens, eight, nines, tens, you know, and then afterwards you went either to secondary,
right, and then you got more specialised
grammar school or whatever, you know, and you know, then the subjects got separated by, you know, people. So that's what I've, you know, do you know, I've got no idea what happens in junior school now.
I can tell you a bit, having, you know, got an 11-year-old son, but it's completely different now. I mean, he's been doing homework for like the last 5 years, and I don't agree with that at all, and he's taking tests and doing evaluations and so on, and it seems to be there's a lot less being a child, you know, you're getting prepared for your career so much earlier on,
yeah,
and streamed and tested.
Yeah.
It's not like it used to be.
Yeah, that seems completely alien, but still it was alien then, it was alien enough then. She was really a very kind woman, really with a bit of sophistication about her. And she was obviously unmarried. She was virtually what they used to call in those days a spinster. But she was I would have married her in a second, you know, even though she was in her 50s. She was a slim woman and, you know, wore, you know, quite fetching cardigans and, you know, she had a bun on the back of her head. You know, I've loved women with buns ever since.
Well, you know, in those formative years, these things have a big impression on a youngster.
They do.
Yeah.
And she was a clever woman too, and, you know, she read us, you know, John Keats and Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and people like that, so you know, Wordsworth and things like that. And I was inspired by that, particularly by Keats at the time. And that's what got me going, because I immediately saw the value in it through her. She was the inspiring bit. You know.
I mean, in that sense, she actually fulfilled the real role of a teacher, really.
Yes,
and
she awakened
your brain and got you thinking. And
yeah, she woke me up to the possibilities of the English language.
Yeah. So, at some point after that, obviously, you devoured literature and poetry, and then started to create your own stuff.
Well, yeah. What happened was that I then wanted to. Of course, I wanted. When I was 11, 12, 13, 14, I wanted to be a poet. There's nothing else I wanted to be. You know, I was really. I was a poet. I was writing things down all the time when I was, you know, but I was in my own shitty little world. But it was a time when music was beginning to become popularized in a different way than it had been in the. As every generation passes, you know, you had. My grandmother's generation were. Then the music of their time, the real music of their time, was the Viennese waltzes. Mm. You know, the turn of the last.
No, I remember, yeah.
19th, 20th century.
Yeah.
And so they were very much that kind of. Those kind of people But my grandmother, she didn't like classical music at all. She hated it. But she loved light orchestral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she used to go off with my Auntie Lily down to St. Anne's Pier in their dotage. And they'd walk 3 miles and 3 miles back to see, what was it? The Palm Court Orchestra. Lionel Johns and the Palm Court Orchestra, you know, on St. Anne's Pier, which is ridiculous stuff, you know, stuff that I would never listen to at all. But that was the previous generation were there.
Mm.
But by the time it had come to the war, and they'd been obviously, they were still in that old world, and the war had taken over. The war songs had taken over, rather a much more American style had come into the, you know, into Britain with the GIs and with the radio, with everything, all of those changes. And let's just say that Bing Crosby was probably the number one star of those days. There were other people, you know, sort of like Doris Day and latterly Frank Sinatra, of course.
Yes.
But that's, you know, the crooners and the, you know, the ballad singers, those kind of guys were the top of the pole, became the top of the pole. There are lots of other things, but that was the overlay. And after the war ended, and I would be, you know, five at the end of the war. Was I five? Yes, so at the end of the war. So after that ended, there was a boom. It took a while, because there were 3 years when there was very, very, very hard times. I remember, you know, not really having that much to eat, although we never went short because, you know, my grandparents were quite well off.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my father was a wastrel, really. But But my grandparents were all came from middle class business people, and my grandfather, for instance, had been a chief buyer in a textile firm in Manchester. And, you know, he'd chosen all the materials that the company were going to use. Mm-hmm. It was a very big company, you know. They all used to sort of take their joint holiday in Bournemouth and, you know, Brighton and, you know, places like that. And you'd see them all together, you know, the whole company, dozens of them, you know. But those times were numbered. They still went on in old age. Like, I'm virtually in old age now, and I do different things than the youth are doing now. Totally different things.
Yeah. Well, you'd expect that. That's the way life moves on.
Yeah, that's the way life is.
Yeah.
But there was the real point where it changed is when sweets came off the rationing in 1948. That was the real change.
Mm.
That was when suddenly there was less of the screws being tightened and they were being loosened.
Mm.
And from 48 onwards to... From 48 onwards to 55, 60, there was a boom. And, you know, I can remember Macmillan, who was Prime Minister then, I can remember him saying, "You've never had it so good." You know,
and that's the famous quote, yeah.
And, you know, that's spot on, actually.
Hmm.
People were beginning to get washing machines, just beginning to get TVs. You know, we had a TV in the house for the 1953 Cup Final with Stan Matthews. And, you know, there were 10, 12, 15 people in that room watching that game. You know, with when my dad got that TV, they got it the day before, I think, got the TV the day before the game. But there was that boom there, and what that boom did was to alter, it was to shuffle away the old world completely, and you got new music came with it. You know, and Sinatra was actually a young man at that point. And he was incredibly famous at that stage, you know, Bobby Sox era. But with that, with the importation of American music like that, it was inevitable that marginal American music was going to follow it.
Yes.
And it did. Yeah. And people like Ahmet Ertegun, who was the founder of Atlantic Records, he'd made Atlantic in the US to sell black people black music. But what they found was that there were a lot of white college students who were buying the music. So, you know, that virtually changed the world, because then it got onto records. You know, the old 78s, you know, the big plastic heavy things, you know. And 45s, and came over here. And so you got, you know, 1954, I can remember a terrible dilemma that was going on in my life. There was, did you become a teddy boy, or were you a beatnik? And it was a really divisive, you know, kind of time to live through in society as a young person. And, of course, I was bohemian by nature. You know, there was no question about where my loyalties were. And, you know, so I would be dressed, you know, as a 15-year-old, I would be dressed in a French or Guernsey pullover, you know, corduroys, sandals, you know, as much bum fluff as I could grow on my face, and a beret, and I was smoking Gauloises, or, you know,
trying to.
You know, so, and the rest of the team, well, some of the team, you know, because by that stage I was at grammar school, and half the class would be teddy boys, and half, the other half would be, you know, bohemian. And
there's
teddy
actually
boys,
a spider on the mic. Sorry, I'm just thinking about you.
Spider on the mic. So the teddy boys were really, you know, their idols were Bill Haley.
Yeah.
And then Elvis Presley, you know, not to name too many, there was quite a few. But Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock was the one that did it.
That really lit
that
the touch
divisive,
paper, didn't it?
You know, okay, you're going that way,
yeah, that's,
I'm going this
right.
way.
Yeah, I see.
So that when Elvis arrived in 54, you know, 55 actually, 55, 56, when he arrived at that stage, I just thought, who the hell is this guy?
Mm.
You know, and I didn't see at the time that he was also a purveyor of black music. That he was, you know, things like Hound Dog were basically black.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and I didn't see that at the time, so I wrote him off. Because he was probably doing the wrong things for me physically.
Yeah.
You know. It was only 10 years later that I saw the value, you know, that Elvis had... I saw the value in Elvis. But so that world was very split. It was incredibly split. And so I went off into my own corner at that stage, and I was writing poems. And blues had suddenly hit us because we of course, we didn't... You know, with Skiffle arrived at the same time as Elvis, absolutely the same time. I mean, Lonnie Donegan is the English Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
Absolutely, no question. And so we were all playing Skiffle, and we were doing that, and it was head-to-head with, you know, the boys who were rock and rollers. And so I carried on getting blues records, because, you know, as soon as you'd heard Donegan, the moment you'd heard Donegan, a second later you knew Leadbelly. And once you'd heard Leadbelly, then you went, and you went into a whole different world, and that world was really surprising and really awe-inspiring. It just opened your life up, because here were people, real people, talking about their lives and what they had to go through, you know, to even begin to have a life. Yeah, so that was the begin. That was where the writing started, and I think that I realized that I wanted to be a poet, and there wasn't any question about that. There was no question about it, but I also wanted to sing blues. Mm. I was inspired by, particularly the first Snooks Eaglin record, which was early 60s, and he was fantastic, blind New Orleans guy. And there were a lot of them. There were a lot of those guys, and so I was inspired to do that. And one of the ways of earning a living in the long run, because in the short run a lot of things happened to me that were, you know, that usually happen to young people who are off the rails anyway, and, you know, I was no exception in those terms. I was off the rails, but there was apart from that, in the long run, I thought that what I really wanted to do was to write poems and play blues on the street, play blues in the clubs, if I could get there, and earn a living that way, so that I could then pay for the poetry.
Right, I see.
So I could then, you know, subsidize.
So you're using the more popularist sort of side of it to
subsidize the poetry,
fund the art.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Now, it was only when I was 20 years old
which is way late. You know, I'd been a poet until I was 20.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was writing stuff like, there's one particular poem that I wrote when I was 16 that I still remember, which, you know, more or less describes a drunken way home. I guess I was 16. I was just, you know, I was beginning to drink at night on a you know, misty, horrible night that you get in the northwest of England. And, you know, that I was intent on doing things like that. And the poem, from memory, the poem goes, the septic bright of puppet show and candles in the void that light my straight, that of my gate, I've a thousand trodden footsteps in the night. I'll remember that later. Yeah, I'll go and have a look at it and remember that later. And I'll, because that was suddenly a thought that I should deliver what I was doing, and I should. Yeah, the dead would rustle millionfold. But it was only when I was 20 that I thought, I can put these together. And that's very late. That's really late. So I was late.
It is, in terms of your classic sort of, you know, teenage angry years and getting the band sorted out, or, you know, getting into music.
That's right. So I was late. You know, I've got contemporaries like, you know, say Pete Townshend, who's, you know, a few years younger than me, who'd already started in music by then. You know, I was playing blues music, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't writing my own my own songs.
Right.
But then when I was 20, I suddenly discovered that that was going to be how I could get the poetry to a mass audience. It was going to be, that's going to be
I mean, was that a case of the fact that music was taking on that kind of different, more serious angle? You said that it was, suddenly it was talking about people's lives and talking about
absolutely
issues, and before that it hadn't, perhaps.
No, it was talking, it was boy-girl.
Yeah.
It was purely boy-girl, and, you know, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Which is all fine and good.
Yeah, it's all brilliant.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, you know, you had the humour songs, you know, like Hound Dog's Howling So Forlorn, he's the laziest critter as ever was born. He's howling because he's sitting on a thorn, too damn lazy to move over.
You can't argue with lyrics like that, can you?
No, no, but, you know, and you had that sort of stuff running alongside, you know, the ancient remains of, or, you know, like light orchestral with crooning. And suddenly, bang, this revolution hits you, particularly youth, because, you know, nobody was any older.
Yeah.
Wanted to know at all. You know, to them it was like the garbage that you hear now. Oh, no melody.
Right. There's no tune in that.
No tune in that.
Thumping bass.
Yeah. That's all that, yeah. That actually started, the modern thing started in when there was the Ford, what was it, the XR3, what was it?
Yeah, what, the souped-up Escort?
It's souped-up Escort, You can, you'd hear it going down the street going,
that's
boom,
right,
boom, 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 boom. You know, at about the rate, heart rate. Just over heart rate, you know. Chores. You know, always actually amused me.
Mm.
So there's another idiot.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, that's I'm showing my prejudice now. So that's where it began. That's where the whole thing started.
Mm.
So before I actually go off on the next tack. Next?
Well, actually, that follows nicely into the next question, really. I mean, I have been going on about the music business and the music scene and everything, and I keep thinking that it must be really different for somebody that's in the position now that you were perhaps in all those years ago, and they've got an idea and they've got something they need to say and they want to get out there and do it. Did you Were you fortunate to be in the right place at the right time when all this stuff was kicking off? And do you think it's any different now for somebody that wants to make their mark?
Well, I don't think I was in the right place at the right time. No, I obviously wasn't, because I was about 5 years late anyway. But, no, because I think that everybody's in the right place at the right time, really. Or, the, you know, if you get killed by a bus, then you're in the right place at the right time.
I take your point, yeah, I suppose so.
But, I just think that, you know, I wouldn't be, in any case, it would be all marginal. Those are kind of fate questions.
Perhaps a different way of asking it is, if you'd been doing it like a decade later or whatever, would everything have been completely different? Was the material a product of its time?
Well, if I'd have been doing it a decade later, I'd have joined in with John Lydon and The Clash, and
that would have been something,
you know, and those guys, I would have done something with them.
Yes, I can see that.
But because I always wanted to, I guess I had an aching to become public, and I don't know that that's really that healthy.
Not necessarily, but I mean, it's part and parcel of doing what you do, isn't it?
Yeah,
and
I think
it's
that
a drive, I suppose.
I think that's got to do with where I came from as a small child, and I think it's got, you know, probably something to do with, it's not that way, I'll show you the way I want to do it.
Yeah,
it's got much more to do with that than with, you know, desire to be celebrity.
Mm.
I have no desire to be a celebrity, actually. None. The times I spend out of this house are, diminishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get onto that a bit later on, maybe. I wanted to talk to you briefly about record companies, because I know that your first...
Hello, Tracy, what do you want?
I told you I'd get you on the podcast at some in some way.
I want money.
Here's a woman, she wants money. Well, fancy that.
You make it, I spend it.
Yeah, no, the only problem is finding it. What do you need it for?
Your pondweed.
Oh, God, no, pondweed's not going to cost anything. Right.
Yeah, I wanted to know about record companies, because you started out on Stripe Records, was it? With that kind of blue target symbol on the cover,
yes,
of the first thing.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know, you've moved on from there through, famously, EMI and Harvest and whatnot, and then went away from them, then came back to them, and then in your latter years, of course, your own record company.
I don't think there was any... I think it was an evolution, that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've not been very proactive when it comes to searching for a new record company, you know, after 1987. I knew it was a dead loss after 87.
Mm.
I mean, I still had hope in 87 of doing something with other people in that respect. But it died. It died there and then. I realised that, you know, I was too old to get the kind of treatment that was needed to actually enable me to make records in the same way that I'd made them.
So you no longer kind of fitted the template that might have been prepared to entertain.
And there was no money coming my way at all.
Yeah.
And it took me a few years to... Not only to understand that properly, although I understood that pretty quickly, but it took me a few years to be able to... issues again. And Bye. Yeah, it took me a few years to properly understand that that wasn't there. What was I going to say? It took me a few years to develop a modus operandi, really.
I can imagine it would do.
And because there was no clear-cut passage, you know, there was nothing that nobody... You were a pioneer.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first there was the sort of record company manned by a friend, you know, manned by someone else. But then I gradually thought that this, I can do this myself. This hasn't got... I'm purely being ripped off again because I'm not actually putting my hands in myself. So, you know, at you know, probably in the 90s, as we got into the 90s, I began to take the whole thing over myself.
That's right, I remember that very well. I mean, I can only see one downside to that, which is that it's just a huge distraction from actually doing the important stuff.
It is. The thing is that it was gradual. At the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, it was gradual. But then all of a sudden, there was a recognition that I had to have my own record company and it had to behave in this manner because I was never going to be able to get the sort of help again that I'd been afforded in the past. And you see, I labored under the illusion that the work was good enough to be selected by not only the music business but the public as well. And I labored under that misinterpretation for a long time until I finally realized that the only thing I could do, and you know, this would be about 90, I'd be about 1990 to be honest. The only thing that I could do was to set up the record company myself and do it myself and have it as a hands-on operation. And you know, we've done it ever since then with a lot of success. It's become a cottage industry. That
I like that term because it's reflecting on the sort of a more modern way of working that I think is happening in a lot of industries.
Well, I never knew anything about the cottage industry. Yeah. I wasn't aware. And the last thing that I would have seen myself doing in 1989 was being, you know, a cottager.
Yeah. Well, let's not go there.
You know, I was the urbane citizen.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, so I thought. City dweller.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so I'd spent sort of time in the country and by the sea and everywhere else. But I was that person who was really, you know, for 21 years I lived in London and I know London like the back of my hand. And I'd still... Mm. You know, if the old Routemaster was still around, I'd be jumping on still at my age, and I would still be jumping off at a speed that I know I could control, you know, getting off a bus. I mean, those are silly, that's stupid stuff to say that, but actually I would be treating London in the same way as I was treating it when I was 21 years old. And that's why, you know, that's, in some ways, that's why you don't get older.
I think growing old is a complete fallacy. I think people expect to suddenly feel old, and it doesn't happen that way. You evolve, and you're still the same person.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've no desire to stop doing the things I'm doing just because some other perceptions come in, like, you're supposed to be retired now, Roy.
Yeah, well.
What? You know, that's
if you,
got
if you listen to
it.
What other people tell you, then that's a then you're a fool with that kind of thing. It's down to the individual.
Yeah, it's an, a completely individual thing. But you know, I've got quite a thing going on in this house with this house, and this house takes up a lot of my time, and I'm very, you know, I'm inspired by it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I don't. To be honest with you, yeah, I don't give a shit about what happens outside. A lot of the time.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I daily catch up with world events. You know, I do.
Mm.
Daily. And there's always a... I've always got a cynical... Well, I wouldn't say I'm cynical, no, but I've always got a sardonic comment for someone.
Mm.
I wouldn't say that I'm not cynical. But, you know, there's always somebody who's in the firing line that would cop for one or two sentences from me. So, you know, I do commute with the world on a daily basis.
Well, I think it's a question of balance as well. Everybody's got their own sort of domestic situation, their own sort of personal life, but also hopefully are aware of what's happening outside of that. And this is partly why I despair about the Big Brother generation and that kind of thing and the dumbing down of media and everything, because I think it's almost encouraging people not to look outside of their house. And I think dragging in cultural references from outside makes us a more rounded person.
Yeah, it's too cosy in there at the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
It's far too cosy. I probably have some ridiculous ideas. I'm thinking myself at the moment that what people actually need in countries like this is for their youth, you know, somewhere between the age of 17 and 21, to actually spend a couple of years giving national service.
I wondered if that's what you were going to say. I used to be vehemently opposed to all of that kind of stuff.
So did I.
I must admit, occasionally, when I see the kids...
No, I just think they need some camaraderie that's not...
Well, it's working together for something, isn't it?
Yes, it's a goal, a shared goal. And, you know, it wouldn't need to be military.
Yeah.
It would need to be, you know, socially motivated. I mean, you could probably choose which branch of society you went into, but of course, you know, we're now touching on a whole thesis, which is huge, you know. Started digging into that one. But I just think that the youth now are not motivated. They're not motivated at all.
Is part of that because life is easier, do you think?
Yes, there is that to it. But on the other hand, life, I think, is harder as well for them.
Mm.
Because it's more difficult to understand the kind of tenets that we had, that we held. Because we held them as opposed to what we were, you know, perhaps given as younger people. Whereas they are not as fiercely aggressive towards their past as perhaps as perhaps we were. I mean, you know, what is it when if you go to your room? But that's no good if your room's got your Wi-Fi and
your DVD player, your PlayStation, and
absolutely useless
web browsers and whatnot. Yeah.
Go to your room does not work.
Yeah,
you know, go to your room is what they want. So you know, it's well, but that's again a sweeping generalization because there's a lot of sweet young people who actually come in to me and say, "Wow, you know, this is something I never heard before," and I'm so glad that I found you.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, and they give you a rundown of what you're doing and you the correct description of
that's a tangential thing, but is it that the media portrays things in a very biased and black and white fashion, and therefore people think that.
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, you know, the one that right now, the one they jumped on is stabbing. You know.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, so there's stabbing going on.
It's getting hysterical.
And it's hysterical, you know. They've forgotten about all the rapes for the moment.
Mm.
You know, the raping's still going on,
but
it's not. You know, hitting the. It's like have these mini movements. They can see it. It's gone. That happened with music, you know. Oh, we'll have the 60s revival this week, you know, and it lasts for 6 months, and then the 70s revival that lasts for 6 months, 7 months.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of, you know, the media do actually pervert things insofar as they claim a certain territory. And milk it dry.
Yes.
Milk it dry with for all it's worth until somebody actually starts another one in another paper.
Right.
You know, and the poor old independent there is still, you know, whacking on about climate change and, you know, having different front pages.
Yeah.
But they do actually join in now and again.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is a paparazzi generated free-for-all out there generally right now.
We did well to get onto that from talking about record companies. That's
oh yeah, well that's the way it goes with me in any case. I mean, you know, it's crazy.
Wouldn't want it any different.
Yeah, I'm not one to interview really. I don't interview well. I'm ridiculous.
I think one of the things that people like about the live Roy is the in-between song dialogue, and I think what I'd hope for in an interview is a kind of version of that, and I think that's what you give. So I wouldn't say it's a bad interview. I think it's just a snapshot actually of thinking and points of view, and I think it's perfectly valid.
Thanks for your
anytime.
Thanks for your support there, Paul.
Anytime,
right? Yeah. I just think I'm a bad interviewee.
Well, I don't think so, but I wanted to briefly talk about.
So that was the end of part one of the three-part interview with Roy Harper. I hope it whetted your appetite for the next two parts, which are a bit longer than this part. I split them up in logical places where we were changing the theme of the discussion. Now, I realise that probably a lot of people will be listening to the podcast for the first time, and hopefully some of you won't have heard Roy's music before, so I've got the enviable opportunity of playing you some tracks and getting you interested. So I thought this was a really good time to play one of Roy's absolute classic love songs. This is Another Day from the album Flat Baroque and Berserk.
The kettle's on, the sun has gone, another day. She offers me Tibetan tea on a flower tray. She's at the door, she wants to score. She dearly needs to say, I loved you a long time ago, you know, where the winds on forget-me-nots blow. But I just couldn't let myself go, not knowing what on earth there was to know. But I wish that I had, 'cause I'm feeling so sad that I never had one of your children. And across the room inside a tomb, her chances waxed and wanes. The night is young, why are we so hungry in each other's chains? I must take her and I must make her, while the dove domains and feel the juice run as she flies. Run my wings under her sighs, as the flames of eternity rise to lick us with the firstborn lash of dawn. Oh, really, my dear, I can't see what we fear, sat here with ourselves in between us. And at the door, we can't say more than just another day. And without a sound, I turn around and I walk away.
That was Legend from Roy's first album, Sophisticated Beggar. Since in the first part of the interview we talked a bit about Roy's beginnings, I thought it was appropriate to play some of the earlier stuff. Now, next for the A to Z of Harper, we're up to the letter L now. And L I've chosen to be Life Mask. Life Mask is an album that Roy brought out in 1973. It was the follow-up to the wonderful Stormcock album. Now, I've done some digging around on the internet and I found out that it was the Mojo magazine disc of the day in April 2008. Phil Alexander has done a lot for Roy in recent years, and I'm going to rather cheekily read out a little bit from the Mojo website. Born with a rare congenital blood disorder, Roy Harper endured a debilitating illness in the wake of his 1971 masterpiece, Stormcock. Fearing the worst, Life Mask was genuinely conceived as a final bow. Its glorious vinyl gatefold sleeve featuring its composer's death mask and opening centrally to reveal Harper very much alive, fixing the listener with one of his trademarked intense stares. Having made his arse-bearing acting debut the year before in Brit flick Made, half of this album features material that appeared on that movie's soundtrack, including the poignant Little Lady. But Life Mask also acted as a repository for Stormcock-era tracks like Highway Blues and South Africa, a love song to calm the fears and wash away the horror and stain of apartheid. Its centrepiece, however, is a funereal 22-minute epic, The Lord's Prayer, featuring Jimmy Page on guitar, which takes up the entirety of Side 2, and which Harper described as my last will and testament. Thankfully, Harper survived Life Mask to enjoy a rich and fruitful career. Today he remains critical of the album, but most particularly The Lord's Prayer. "I do wish we'd added orchestration because it feels unfinished," he told Mojo last year. In truth, Life Mask is perhaps fractionally a less challenging work than Stormcock. Nevertheless, it provides a further example of Harper's unique take on acoustic music, showcasing his lyrical dexterity and vocal versatility, lush neoclassical aspirations and wry wit, marking him out as one of the most singular voices of his generation. I've chosen the track All Ireland to play from the album.
Gone, and there'll not be a new song. Till it's been done.
Time for some listener feedback now. First of all, for episode 11, which featured an interview with Chris Politsky from the USA, Fuzzy TNTH3 commented on Mick Bordet's ukulele voicemail, musical voicemail. He said, "Darn it, Mick beat me to it. I was thinking of doing a ukulele voicemail thingy, but as ever, my ability to write a tune, let alone string some words together, defeated me. But who was on backing vocals and backing Yuki? Or was it lead Yuki? Well, I actually suspect some overdubbing went on there, which, as we all know, is really not in the spirit of these things at all." He also says, "Chris came across as a very nice, humble kind of guy. Weirdly, of late, I've been driving my biddy in, the boss as she likes to be called, daft with constantly singing Kangaroo Blues, albeit I can never remember all the words. So you have most likely doomed the boss to another week or so of me failing to sing Kangaroo Blues correctly. But I hope you're still alive after subjecting your poor wife to that." Chris followed up on his interview and said, "Seems I didn't get to mention everything I aimed to mention. Wanted to throw out there that I was at the Oval Cricket Ground when Roy did his reissue press release, that's of HQ. And in mid-set, he decided to go backstage and reinvent himself. Well, for you that don't know, he proceeded to shave his full-grown beard, which he'd grown in India. I believe I videotaped the whole process with Nick and Darren. Needless to say, he looked much younger after doing so and shocked the members of the press in doing so. A fond memory which I failed to share in the podcast." And I replied and said, "Blimey, I was there as well. I don't remember talking to you, Chris, but the ravages of time have probably taken their toll there." I had some extensive feedback from Alan Jones, and he in particular is really, really keen to hear more about, if not hear the music of, the Roy Harper of Finland called Hector that was mentioned in a voicemail last time. He also says, "Can anyone else think of anyone that's has covered or plagiarised Roy's songs apart from Kate Bush and Another Day?" On Genesis, is "The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway," the guitar riff is the "How Does It Feel" riff. That's interesting. I'll have to listen to that again, actually. I'll try and pick that up. He also commented on my discussion about the celebrity aspect of Roy, whether it was a good thing or not that he had Zeppelin and Floyd and Kate Bush's patronage. And he says, "I think the Pink Floyd, Zep, Kate Bush connection does no harm. It may not do anything positive. For example, the girl I most wanted to go out with in 1972 had a copy of Led Zeppelin 3 with hats off to Roy Harper, but despite me explaining who he was and inflicting my Roy Harper albums on her, she kept confusing him with Roy E. Gallagher. But I did get to marry her, so all's well that ends well. Congratulations," a bit late there. But it does suggest that it tempts people to listen. I come at it from a different angle. Harper made a home in my heart long before any of the celebrity apostles did. Okay, nice thoughts there. And moving on to the Matt Churchill special, Dave Burnham says, "I really enjoyed this one, Paul. As a lapsed guitarist, it was one of those conversations that made me want to go and blow the dust off my old acoustic. Always interesting to hear how musicians get started and what their influences were or are. I can understand Matt's initial reticence in taking Roy up on his offer, but wow, can you imagine? His embellishments do sit very well with Roy's work live, and excellent that he put his own stamp on it, keeping it fresh, letting it grow. Nice one, Dave of the Burnham variety." Scott Paula Bear says, "Well, Paula Bear, I think I'm going to start calling you that now, Paula. Well deserved. Not only is Matt a great guitarist, but he's a real sweetheart too." Big grin. Sean says, "Enjoyed that bonus one-off episode, Paul. It was interesting to hear Matt's early influences and favourite artists, e.g. Zappa, Vai and Satriani. The guitar geekness was also interesting, though you lost me when talking of guitar string weights, etc. Love Matt's stuff too. I look forward to the next podcast. I sat down to have a coffee and a break from my glossing." I guess we're talking about paint here. "And before I knew it, an hour had passed. Keep up the good work." Well, cheers. Fuzzy TNTH3, one of my regular correspondents, also was pleased with that podcast. and says, practice, practice, practice. But it was interesting hearing Matt recommending having lessons as both a way of being disciplined about practicing and also to avoid developing bad habits or getting stale. I've never had lessons as such, although I did attend a guitar workshop at a Dougie McLean weekend, which I did at least learn some tunes in C tuning that I'd never have sussed out otherwise. So maybe I should be looking into that. He also talks a little bit about something he's read in Andy Roberts' blog about his approach to songwriting and stuff that he'd been learning from that. He says, my songwriting tip, as it has been the most productive for me, two songs so far, is ride a bike in the countryside. As you keep a steady pace, you can hum tunes and come up with lyrics as you go along with no distractions. Well, mostly as you have to watch out for your typical UK BMW and Volvo car drivers. I'd like to add, especially if they're wearing hats. Only downside to this method is that once you've sussed something out, you have to keep repeating it till you get home to write the blooming thing down. Bob Jacobs said, Matt made a very interesting interviewer. You hired him pegged as an acoustic guitarist, thanks to his involvement with Roy, but clearly that's not really his main interest. And he also says, incidentally, is he aware of the Australian group The Church? It might be wise to change the group's name to avoid confusion. Good point, don't know. Matt, if you're listening, there you go. LA Drain says, a very nice interview with Matt. Let's hope this may be the first of a few going into the how and why of playing music. An hour with Roy and his guitar explaining his songs is something I can only dream about. It would have been nice, though, to understand from Matt as to how he fills in the gaps. Yeah, actually, I would like to get a little bit more music technical on the podcast. The interview with Roy, as you'll discover over the next month or so, is more about the songwriting and the his career and everything else, and we didn't go into an awful lot of detail about the structure of the songs, and I think that is something I would like to bring out again, so thanks for that pointer there. Okay, some credits and contact information. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which basically means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. Now, if you'd like to contact the podcast, there are a number of ways you can do this. If you go to www.stormcock.net, you will find show notes, and if you have an account on that site, you can add comments. A lot of the ones I read out earlier came from there. There are also forums on the same site, and there's a podcast forum there, and you can add your comments there also. The other thing you can do is record a voicemail. I didn't have any this month to play, unfortunately, but I really like receiving them. If you've got the ability to record an MP3 of you speaking out your message, please do that and email it to me, pd@stormcock.net, and I'll play it. I love those. The other thing you can do is ring a voicemail number in the UK, 01223 850282, or you can call from abroad, +44 1223 850282. There's a 90-second limit on those, so you better practice being really succinct, otherwise you'll get cut off. If you like the podcast and you want to help me get it more popular on iTunes, if you use iTunes, please do enter a review. Just give it a star rating and possibly some text comments if you feel like it. If you have money burning a hole in your pocket, there is a PayPal link on stormcock.net, and any money you pay towards the podcast will be used to cover the hosting fees plus any other bits and pieces of equipment that I need to do the podcast, and it would be very much appreciated, but it is by no means required. Okay, very nearly at the end of the podcast. The next one will be out in 2 weeks' time. For now, we're going to close with the track Manana off of Roy's album Folk Joke Opus. See you next time.
And in a moment, the marks for artistic interpretation. Manana.
Until we meet again now.
insane, but there's mania. I'm horizontal now, but I'll get up somehow, baby. And maybe we'll all goof again someday. The drunken frogs will somersault all day. You'll still be up the creek, yes. But here's your favorite freak, baby, and he'll be with you all the drunken way. Oh man, yeah, no. Just the same old joke again, man, yeah. We'll all be just as broke, the same man, yeah. Baby, you're a painted screw, and look out, the moon's about to spew. But never mind, it's all just forgetting on toast. Oh, some more mania. The great big floating toilet in the sky. We'll go and rape some queers and beat up some oldies, baby, and smash a few more windows by and by. Sing a few pop songs to fill a few more lungs, babe, with apathetic garbage number one. Oh man, yeah. We'll help ourselves to lots more toilet roll. We'll do the dirty dog, sat on the dirty bog, baby, and sell it to the Yanks as English soul. I'll add that out for dripping. Sell it to the Yanks as English soul. Da 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 da.
Okay.